Coming up on Boston Public Radio with midterm elections just 2 months away, CNN's John King joins us to handicap GOP chances to take over the Senate and to predict the president's next moves on immigration and ISIS. Then with primary day just a week off, the three Democrats for governor and the lead Republican will join us in the studio this week. Dr. Donald Berwick is first up.
Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School on the renting versus owning economy. With a big push for millennials, renting is on overdrive. We'll ask you, is owning overrated, passe, not worth the hassle? Then Martha Coakley, the attorney general who hopes to be our next governor, joins us in Studio 3. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You know what happens in 20 days, Marjorie?
What happens in 20 days?
No, I asked you. What happens in 20 days?
I know what happens in 20 days. We expand to 3 hours. Instead of starting at noontime, we'll be starting at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Very nicely
done. And
I'll
be saying 89.7, 11 o'clock in the morning, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Beautifully put.
I thought you were going to give me the 20-day weather report.
So is the elephant in the room that the GOP has some electoral dysfunction, still having a problem with women voters? Could the prospect of sweeping the midterm elections be escaping the Republicans' grasp? And is Elizabeth Warren, our senator, alienating her progressive base? You know, it's one thing to be tough on big banks, quite another, apparently, to be hawkish on the West Bank. Joining us on that line to talk about these and other headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, as you know, is also the host of Inside Politics. Good afternoon, John King.
Good afternoon, and congratulations on the extra hour. I guess maybe some days I'll be saying good morning. Who knows?
That's well made, John.
And I want to tell you, John, lots of people have been asking. They've missed you while you've been gone and while we've been gone. So I just want you to know you are beloved here at WGBH. Anyway, we're going to get
My Red Sox therapy. It's over. I'm okay.
We're going to get to some of the items Jim mentioned in just a couple of minutes, but there is some breaking news. National Public Radio, NPR, just reported that a drone strike has hit and killed the al-Shabaab leader who was responsible, as many people recall, for that massacre in the shopping mall in Nairobi that killed 70 people. What do we know about this, John?
We're awaiting official confirmation from the Pentagon. Admiral Kirby briefed this afternoon. And that's going to be the biggest question, because we do know, I know from our Pentagon team and our State Department team, that was what they were shooting at, that what we're hearing from intelligence sources and military sources is that they had a target of opportunity. They've been watching for some time, hoping, as we've seen in other, you know, think of the American Anwar al-Awlaki, other terrorists, where they try to keep an eye on them. They try to get good information that they're in one place. And apparently they received intelligence they trusted that the al-Shabaab number one, plus a number of his top deputies, we're having a meeting, and that's why they authorized the drone strike to go after him. And from sources we're hearing, they believe that raid was a success, meaning they got the number one and some of his deputies. And I'm sure this is going to dominate the Pentagon briefing later this afternoon.
Now, I'm assuming that if this is confirmed later this afternoon, some of the criticism, not just from Republicans, from Democrats as well, of what the president had to say late last week will be muted. For those who were vacationing at the time, here's Barack Obama.
I don't want to put the cart before the horse. We don't have a strategy yet. I think what I've seen in some of the news reports suggests that folks are getting a little further ahead of where we're at than we currently are. And I think that's not just my assessment, but the assessment of our military as well.
Now, and the lack of strategy was for dealing with the Islamic, with ISIS or ISIL, whatever you call it, in Syria. I'm assuming, again, that if this Somalia hit was as successful as it appears, a lot of those critics are going to be silenced, are they not?
Oh, I doubt they'll be silenced in this political environment, but I do think you will have, you know, if you're a Dianne Feinstein and you're a Democrat and you just said you think the president sometimes is too cautious, you're going to have to say, well, in this case, I guess he wasn't, right? And if you're the Republicans, I suspect what you'll hear, and people will have the political debate about whether this is fair or right, or you know how cynical they are or whatever, they'll say, good for you on this one, Mr. President, but we still think you're being too timid and too cautious on the more difficult challenge. This is not easy, and anyone who thinks it's easy is nuts. If this is what has happened and the military has pulled this off successfully, it's something they've been trying to do for quite a long time. And so anyone who says it's easy is nuts, as I said. But people will say, well, okay, that's al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab is a, B or an A-minus grade terrorist organization. Now you got to go after the real guys, and the real guys are, have control of most of Iraq or much of Iraq, and their headquarters and their leadership is based in Syria. Keep going. Go after them as well. I don't think the course of criticism, my point is that I don't think the course of criticism is going to slow down. But if the president has a success in the counterterrorism department, it'll no doubt help him at a time where he's struggling, without a doubt. And one more quick point. I hate to ramble, but I hope people understand the context, and I'm not defending the president. But the Twitterverse went crazy with we don't have a strategy, and I think he should know better than to use words like that. He's way too smart, whether you like his politics or not. But the specific question was, are you about to bomb inside Syria? And people took the we don't have a strategy to mean he doesn't have a strategy about breakfast, lunch, dinner, and, everything else in the world.
Well, we've been reading over the weekend, John King from CNN, that David Cameron, the prime minister over in England, is going to toughen up on the security of the passports for people that he thinks may be leaving the United Kingdom or coming back to the United Kingdom that may be involved in these terrorist organizations and stuff. I mean, what are the Republicans and Democrats saying that a Barack Obama should be doing? What are the options?
Well, I think when it comes to homegrown threats or Americans who are going abroad to join organizations, we're now having, I think, even a more intense conversation because it appears that ISIS or ISIL, depending on the terminology you use, is having as much, if not more, success than, remember, again, I mentioned al-Awlaki a few minutes ago, as we talked about this with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula a few years back. After, even after the death of bin Laden in that strike, there was talk that this other group was radicalizing Westerners and including Americans. So there'll be that pressure to deal with the homeland front. When it comes to Prime Minister Cameron, I think that the biggest question is, and this is part of the issue here, is Prime Minister Cameron, like President Obama, is not in the greatest political shape back home. Prime Minister Cameron, like President Obama, has an electorate, has a country of people who have an Iraq war hangover, who are very reluctant because of Iraq and Afghanistan to project military force, to believe their leaders when they say we can do this on a limited basis. And so you have frustrated electorates who say, don't dare put boots on the ground. Don't engage us in overseas military affairs. But why can't we do more to influence the world? And why are these things getting worse, not better? And those are the conflicting pressures on both of the leaders who you think about the NATO meeting that's about to happen. If you're going to move NATO to do more, almost always it's because the United States and the UK and then somebody else jumps up and leads the charge. So watch Prime Minister Cameron just as we watch President Obama because of the politics back home.
Well, speaking of NATO and speaking of Cameron and Obama being outliers, it seems that one of their missions, particularly the president's in the wake of the execution of James Foley, is to convince some of our Western allies that ransom shouldn't be paid to international terrorist kidnappers. What's the morning line? What's the betting line as to whether or not Obama has a chance of succeeding on that front, John King?
This is I'm going to call it a cultural divide, a way of doing business divide that has persisted for some time. And other countries that are with the United States on most things have a different perspective on this question. I think it will be a source of conversation. How much of the conversation it dominates is a big question mark for me because I used to go to these NATO summits with Presidents Clinton and Presidents Bush back in the day, and most of them were pretty boring. Some of them were involved in the middle of the Iraq War, and you had big questions about that. But there was most of the conversation was, what is NATO for now? When everybody was talking about, Russia was a partner, and we're going to have economic and security relationships with Russia. Well, forget about that now. NATO now has brand new urgency in Europe's backyard because of Putin's belligerent behavior. And I think that's going to dominate. And I think the president's going to have a hard time getting much oxygen for any other conversation. And it's not a criticism. It's just because of the urgency of Putin that if he wants to talk about, hey, please don't pay ransom because of the signal it sends, he'll make his point in the meeting. But I don't think the meeting's going to be dominated by that. It's going to be about Putin. I think it's also going to complicate his efforts to get help against ISIS inside Iraq or maybe to rally some consensus to do something across the border into Syria. Just because this threat, especially to the new NATO members, the Baltic states, and because it's more local for the other older traditional NATO members, they want to focus more on Putin and what to do.
We're talking with John King from CNN. John, you talked about this on your show, your Sunday morning show, Inside Politics, that, you know, the word has always been that's going to be, especially with Obama's popularity tanking, that there's going to be a big midterm win for the Republicans. They need, of course, six seats to win a majority in the Senate. So not so much of a big win is now being predicted. No landslide, but still enough for six seats or not?
I don't think anybody sees a big wave, and that's in part because as weak as the president is politically, you know, an approval rating in the low to mid-40s, dominated now by these, I'll call it the world on fire, sort of dragging him down even a little bit more or preventing him from getting back up. The counterbalance to that is the Republican brand is so damaged. If you look around the country, there aren't people saying, well, it's okay that President Obama's in a tough stretch or the Democrats in a tough stretch because I just love the Republicans. And I think what they're selling is great. So you've got, you know, two cars with no tires on the track. And so it's not a very compelling race at the moment. So what does that mean? It means we go state by state and we go race by race. And we don't have a wave like we had in 2006 when the Democrats won big because of Iraq war on popularity. And we don't have a wave in 2010 when the Republicans won big because of anger at healthcare and the birth of the Tea Party. So you have to play chess, and you go state by state. And, you know, can the Democrats pull off a few surprises, like in Kentucky and Kansas, to make the Republican math harder? Will the Republicans win the ones they're supposed to? South Dakota, West Virginia, Montana, start there. If they get those three, they need three more. Where do they get them? Well, they've got tie races now, dead heats essentially, in Alaska, in Arkansas, in Louisiana, in North Carolina. Just to the north of you guys, a pretty close race. Gene Shaheen's still ahead, but within reach for the Republicans in New Hampshire. Very close race in Iowa. So will the Republicans get the six? If the election were tomorrow, I think the answer is yes. But they might get five. They might get eight. We're going to go through this for the next 2 months. And another big question is how many did they get in the House? Republicans had hoped to gain 15 at the beginning of the year. There's not that many competitive House races, so you don't get these huge waves in the House anymore because of redistricting. But they had hoped to get, you know, 15, maybe 18, and they said a dozen would be good. Now, there's a story in Politico today, and it's smartly reported. This is a lot of Republican strategists think they might get five or six. That would give John Boehner a slightly bigger majority, but not a huge majority. And this matters, not only because how much leeway does Boehner have with the Tea Party over the next 2 years, but if Boehner only gets five or six, and then a Democrat wins the presidency in 2016, they might get the House back because, you know, in that first presidential election, you tend to have coattails.
Yeah, but John, even if he doesn't get the seats in the House, he's gaining seats in investment banking with Eric Cantor moving there. Hey, John.
I read his salary and drooled.
Hey, John, just for a second before we leave that topic, you, as a throwaway line, mentioned Kentucky could be a Republican seat lost to the Democrats. Whenever I think of Mitch McConnell now, obviously the minority leader in the Senate, I think of Obama's great line at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He says, what does he say? People keep saying to me, you should go have a drink with Mitch McConnell. And he pauses and says, you go have a drink with Mitch McConnell. Is there a real shot that McConnell's going to be retired?
We have new poll numbers coming out at 4 o'clock this afternoon, and I, honest to God, haven't seen the final numbers, so I'm not keeping them from you. I try to somehow wink, nod, leak them to you, and then get fired. We know that this is a really close race. So it has been all along. I would say this, I'm serious, I haven't seen the final numbers yet, you know, whether they show McConnell up a few or McConnell down a few or statistical dead heat. Most states, come election day, return to their DNA. So I have a hard time, you know, I see a very steep hill for Allison Grimes, in the sense that Kentucky has not elected a Democrat to the United States Senate since 1992. That was the year Bill Clinton was running for president, and he was from Arkansas, and, you know, he actually won Kentucky once. So I don't see it. It's hard to see it happening, but that's the kind of year we're in, that it's not out of the realm of possibility, because the Obama dynamic, anti-Obama, anti-any president, because it's the sixth year, it's election year, is one dynamic. But people are so disgusted with Washington that if you're a younger, next-generation candidate, as Allison Grimes is, and you can run against your opponent saying, this is the problem. I mean, Mitch McConnell, she is trying to make Mitch McConnell the poster child for gridlock and everything you hate about Washington. And it's not just the people in Massachusetts who are disgusted or the people of Florida who are disgusted. Everybody across the country is disgusted with Washington. And Mitch McConnell happens to have the title Republican leader. It's a tough one. That is big baggage in this election year. And, yes, it's conceivable he loses. Now, he's had tough races in the past, and he usually wins. Kentucky has Republican DNA. But the fact that we're going to watch it right up to the last week tells you something about the wacky environment out there.
Well, you wonder, John King from CNN, if some of this is linked to the whole, you reported about this on your show too, the GOP going out and polling about their problem with women. And of course, the woman in Kentucky is a Democrat, and finding out that they think the GOP has got big problems, these women do. They think they're intolerant and stuck in the past. And there's a quote here about how they fail. This is the GOP, failed to speak to women in different circumstances in which they live. There's almost this assumption in some quarters of the Republican Party that every woman in America, you know, is a stay-at-home mom and wants to have six children, and that isn't the reality anymore. And they haven't made any headway on this.
They haven't made any headway, and they haven't made any headway here. If you had a huge problem, if your company, if you weren't selling, you know, a certain car anymore, if people weren't buying your phone anymore, or if people weren't listening to your program anymore, you might do research, and that would be smart, right? So the Republicans are smart if they think they have a problem with women, and they have a demonstrable problem with women, to do the research. The problem is in today's politics, there are too many children, and I don't mean age has nothing to do with that, who think it's then their responsibility to take the most sensitive internal document, and thank God for them if you're a reporter, and leak it to the press. If the Republicans want to study their problems, they have every right and every reason, just as the Democrats do and anybody else, to spend some money on private research and try to study what do people think about us. It's good to learn what people think about you, especially if what they think about you is pretty horrible, so that you can change your ways. But then to leak it out, it backfires when you leak it out to the media and they write these stories about you in the middle of a very competitive election cycle. But look, it's great for the people in our business, and it was Politico, I believe, that first got a hold of this. I want to give them the credit for it. But there are, you know, too many people in politics who think this is the way to make a friend, to leak some damning internal conversation, and it made the Republicans look stupid.
Let's talk presidential for a minute, John King. My name is Jim Browdy, and I am poll obsessed. When I saw the poll out of Iowa on the Republican side suggesting that if Mitt Romney gives it a third go, he crushes the opposition, after smiling for a second, I'm saying to myself, is it because they're fond memories of Mitt Romney, particularly compared to the guy who beat him, or is it because he's really the only name the potential caucus goers recognize? What's the answer to that?
I think it's a mix. I don't underestimate the growing appeal of Mitt Romney in the sense that I think that, you know, with President Obama down, I think there are some people in the middle out there who have a bit of buyer's remorse, who might vote differently if they could take it back and do it over again, or who at least have more respect for Mitt Romney because some of the things he said seem to ring true, whether it's about Russian foreign policy or whether they're, you know, whether their own economic situation hasn't improved, and they think, well, maybe we should have tried something different. In the specific context of the Republican subset, number one, most of these other guys are relatively unknown. You know, Rand Paul's working it hard. Chris Christie's a national name, but people, you know, haven't really, you know, kicked the tires all that much yet. So part of it is name ID, but part of it also is, I think, a growing respect. Sometimes you don't hear a lot of talk about George W. Bush. He left the scene, and Republicans don't bring him up that much anymore. But when you talk to Republicans about leaders they respect, even a lot of people who, you know, would kick Romney for the flip-flops and everything else years ago respect him. And they also respect the fact that he's willing to get back into the arena even after he lost and try to help the Republican Party. Is he going to run? He keeps saying no. He did this Dumb and Dumber routine on the radio the other day where he did leave open, you know, if you know the movie, the one in a million possibility. And I do think it's still a possibility. If the other guys, you know, fluster or they think none of these guys is up to running against Hillary Clinton, I think it is a tiny, tiny, tiny possibility. But I wouldn't bet more than a nickel on it because I think when we get to that point, he's going to realize, I've done this twice. He's not old or anything. He seems fit and healthy. But I've done this twice. I'm not a spring chicken. No, thank you.
We're talking to John King from CNN. Speaking of not a spring chicken, I think people have been wondering about the health of Hillary Clinton if she does run for president. How's her summer been, John? A lot of talk about that as well.
I don't think it has anything to do, you know, with her age. I guess, you know, she'll be in her mid to late 60s when she's running for president in 2016. She seems to be okay. There were all the questions about the concussion and all that. I don't think she's had a great summer from a communication standpoint. I don't think she's had a great summer from people thinking, you know, has she learned from some of the mistakes, her stylistic mistakes in 2008. I will say that a lot of people criticized her for waiting 3 weeks, and I don't quite understand why she waited 3 weeks, but I do think what she said about Ferguson was very powerful. And I think that if you can have a white political leader in the United States of America who will travel the country and go to predominantly white audiences and say, look around the room, Imagine if your life were like that. Imagine if every time you got behind the wheel of a car, you thought you were going to get pulled over. Imagine if every time you got pulled over, you were going to get searched. I give her credit for that, for being part of that. And I'm going to say that Rand Paul is saying the same thing. And I think it's good for the country to have people on different, very different extremes of our political spectrum trying to have that conversation. But listen, we can answer this in one sentence, saying it almost doesn't matter whether she had a good or a bad summer unless there's somebody to oppose her.
Well,
Bernie Sanders, if you're saying Hillary Clinton, a young dynamo in her 60s, well, Bernie Sanders is going to be 73 years old next week.
Right.
And he was at the Labor Day picnic in New Hampshire. He's a Democrat socialist. He's an interesting guy. He's a fun guy. I view him as, if you can think back to 1992, in the end, Jerry Brown stayed in and kept running against Bill Clinton and gave him fits. He was never going to knock him out, but boy, did he give him fits. I sort of view Bernie Sanders as, sort of the guy who keeps coming up with the dog that keeps sneaking up on you and biting you in the you-know-what. But I don't see anybody yet who's got a chance to knock her off, but we got a ways to go. So people will run. I assume people will run just for the chance.
So are you eliminating our own senior senator, Elizabeth Warren, from that group?
I take her at her word until it's time to not take her at her word. And we have plenty of time for her to change her mind. At the moment, all indications are she's not going to do it. Again, she doesn't, sing. She always says Hillary Clinton's fine. She doesn't say Hillary Clinton's great. She doesn't say I'm excited about it. But again, Elizabeth Warren would have great strength, but she would also be a first-time national candidate.
She's taking some flack for being too hawkish now from the progressive wing of the party on foreign policy stuff. Like Hillary.
Welcome to national politics, right? Because she's, said some things about Israel has a right to defend itself, because she said some things that, I don't like civilian casualties in Gaza, but it's Hamas's fault because they're putting rocket launchers next to schools or next to camps. Some on the left are saying, oh, gosh, is she too hawkish? And now she's going to go to Israel, but right after the election, right? And so as she raises her profile, the first reflex is for the left is to love her because they love her economic views. But, yeah, they're going to try to scrub her foreign policy views as well. And you do have some progressives saying, maybe she's not, completely one of us.
Hey, John, last thing from me is we have been getting immigration updates from you for months and months and months.
Sorry for wasting your time.
No. Well, I'm not sure that we're wasting anybody's time, because it appears that some executive order is in the works. And I guess two questions. One, do we have any greater sense about how broad this is going to be? And two, do we have any greater sense as to whether or not it's going to happen pre-November 4th, or is the president waiting until after the midterms? What's your sense?
Let's take them backwards. I can't answer the timing question. And 10 days ago, I would have told you all indications are it was going to come as early as this week. That it was going to come after he was back from a summer vacation, so meaning early to mid-September. But there is a feisty debate within the White House and the president's team outside of the White House throughout the administration over both points, how bold to be and when to do it. And they are, apparently, it's healthy. They all like each other, but apparently this is a healthy, bruising battle over how much legal authority do we have? How bold can we be? Can we give de facto amnesty to a good chunk of the undocumented, meaning several million people here in the United States? If the president does that before the election, it's going to have a huge impact on things. And a lot of Democrats are worried about that, because if you look at the Senate races, while nationally the Democratic base might say, thank you, Mr. President, if you look at where those Senate races are, places like Arkansas, places like Alaska, places like North Carolina, a lot of Democrats think this will rile up the Republican base, and there are not enough Latino voters in those states, or even, base voters, who are going to come out and counterbalance that. Last week we started to hear they might wait till after the election, and we're going to have to figure this one out.
Hey, John, before you go, Marjorie and I are big planners, as you probably know. We're planning out the next 5 months of the show, and we just need to understand, just contextually, we understand on a scale of 1 to 100, your intensity for your passion for the Red Sox as a Dorchester native is 100. Where are you on the Patriots scale, or are they like an afterthought in your mind?
Oh, no, they're right there. Baseball is my first love, so if the Red Sox might be, a million, and the Patriots are only 999,999.
So we can discuss the first game next week. Hey, John King, it's great to talk to you as always. Thanks so much. Happy Labor Day.
Take care.
See you later, John. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. He's also the host of Inside Politics, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 8:30. Coming up, Democrat Don Berwick joins us as we continue our final round with the gubernatorial candidates before next week's primary, just a week from today.
It is indeed.
Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're continuing our final round of interviews with the gubernatorial candidates before next week's primaries, in fact, next Tuesday's. Here with us in Studio 3 is Democrat Don Berwick. Don is a pediatrician and the former head, is it Medicare and Medicaid or Medicaid? Which is it?
It's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid
Services. Okay, thank you very much, Don. He was the chief of that during the Obama administration. Don, it's great to see you.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you for being here. So you're very well known as an advocate for single-payer health care. Reading the front page of the Globe today that spending on health care has risen in the state at Blue Cross and Blue Shield and Partners. Not hugely, but it's gone up. What are we to make of this, Dr. Single-Payer?
It's pretty much business as usual, and we have to change it. You're looking in this state at people paying, I think it's, did it say $7,550 per person, the highest in the nation.
Yes.
So remember, at an individual level, we're the most costly healthcare system in the most costly country in the world. And until we make changes that really, really matter to deliver better care to people at lower costs, which I've worked on for 30 years, we're going to be taking resources from other needed investments on the public and private side and putting them into healthcare. And single-payer healthcare matters a lot. It's one of the ways to get real waste out of the healthcare system and really reorient the system toward helping people instead of wasting money on paperwork and confusion that just takes resources from everyone.
Now, I should say that Partners does say that these numbers are not correct and they're going to have better numbers. But this does give weight to your argument against the Attorney General, Martha Coakley. She's allowed Partners Healthcare to take over control of these three South Shore hospitals with a range of caveats. But it's been criticized by others as meaning more money for Partners and Blue Cross. What's your take on that?
Well, I came out against that deal the minute it was announced. The treasurer supported it at first and then apparently changed his mind.
Steve Grossman.
But I knew from the start this is another step toward increasing costs without the discipline and value we need to add back to healthcare. Partners is a wonderful organization. Let's not get that wrong. It's a world-leading organization. That's really why this is especially disappointing. We should be challenging one of the best healthcare organizations in the world to help us solve the problem, better care at lower costs. They could do that if we pitched them the right pitch. What Martha Coakley did was give away the store. She chiseled the status quo into the agreement with Partners so that they can keep their prices where they are now, plus an increase the rate of inflation at a time when they really need to be playing a totally different game. And you're seeing it here. Partners is the one it's the most expensive example in the Commonwealth. You saw that their costs went up. I think the estimate in the report was 4% when others in the state were going up at a slower rate. Although actually we need to bring costs down. This is money taken from workers, is taken from businesses, is taken from the public treasury, and it could be – we really have other uses for that money. And I'd feel differently if that extra cost was buying extra better health care. It isn't. This nation's 41st in the world in life expectancy. We're not getting value for that. And I've worked for 30 years on how you get better care at lower cost. And you've heard me say I think we better have a governor in that corner office that really understands what the future of healthcare ought to look like and is willing to have the guts to lead us there on behalf of the people.
Let's stay on the single payer thing, Don Berwick, for a couple of minutes. Assuming that you would acknowledge that single payer is not right around the corner, even if you're elected governor, how do you rein in the healthcare costs that you're just talking about? on your way to single payer in Massachusetts?
Well, first, Jim, I think the corner is closer than it may look, and we certainly won't have it. Elect any of the other candidates for governor, we will not have single payer health care. Steve Grossman says he wants a conversation. I'm saying this is the conversation. Martha Coakley is saying not now, and Charlie Baker ran an insurance company. He's not going to go for this. With strong gubernatorial leadership.
He had thousands of employees, too, who'd be out of work if you had your way. Is that not so?
Let's talk about that first, okay? There is a change in our health insurance system if we move to single-payer health care, and that change is a dislocation for the industry. There are people who currently have jobs for whose those jobs wouldn't exist anymore. Those are jobs producing a lot of extra paperwork for people. I have great compassion for these people. We really need to have a glide path and a way to help the people in the insurance industry whose jobs would go away. Not all of them, by the way. We need the insurance industry as a transaction assistant to a single-payer system. So a lot of those jobs will be saved. But we have to zoom out to the big picture here. Remember, healthcare is 42% of our state budget. It's about 18% of our economy. And if you go to talk to business leaders and say, what's the biggest problem for you staying in the state of Massachusetts as opposed to moving or adding new products or new plants or paying your workers more, I'll tell you they will list healthcare costs at number one or two on that list. So single-payer health care, because it would reduce costs, I think by about 10% overall, without harming anyone at all on the care delivery side, it's the biggest job-creating strategy we could have. On the private side, money goes back to laborers who haven't seen a real increase in their take-home pay in a decade. All of that money's gone to health care and to businesses to expand. And it goes back to the government. What will we use that money for? How about building better roads and bridges? What about really developing a great public transportation system? What about supporting our schools, our higher education schools more? Those are jobs added. And when you add it all up, single-payer health care is the best route this Commonwealth could take to real job growth and expansion as opposed to taking that money away from workers and businesses.
Okay, so on the road to there, and you say it's a lot closer than I characterize it as being, how do you cut those healthcare costs on the front page of the Globe and Herald today?
Well, we need to push very hard on healthcare delivery systems partners and others to move toward truly integrated healthcare. That is, that may sound like jargon. It's sensible care. It's the kind of team-based care you want. You want care that's going to keep you home. Who wants to be in a hospital bed, really? And if we have ways to help you be home, to be healthy, to be vibrant in your life, if you have chronic illness, a way to keep you able to function in your life, that reduces cost. That's better care at lower cost. And the organization that I started and ran for is now 25 years old, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, we talked about the triple aim, better care, better health, and lower cost. Now, that means changing the payment system, single payer or not, toward more global payments so that healthcare providers can move the money where it needs to go. If we're going to keep you at home, you need someone to visit you at home. You need education on how to care for yourself. You need good telemedicine support, real innovations that would make a difference. We know what those look like. And in fact, we have models of that in the Commonwealth. What, for example, Dr. Robert Master has done with people with very serious chronic illness is a world-leading example of really better care at lower cost. And we need someone in the governor's office, like me, who understands what these models look like and is going to insist that these develop all over the system.
That's Dr. Donald Berwick. He's running for governor in the Democratic primary next Tuesday.
So we will move on to casinos now, Jim?
Well, yes, okay, we can.
You? Okay. you support the ballot question, which would repeal casinos, and you don't want any more casinos in Massachusetts. That's different from your opponents. Coakley said, for example, that she would keep an open mind about the casino in Springfield, even if the voters do repeal, because Springfield is in a mess economically. What's wrong with that? If Springfield really wants one, they're not a thriving city. What's wrong, Dr. Berwick, with coming back with an option for Springfield if the voters get rid of casinos?
Well, I've been in Springfield and in the western part of Massachusetts a lot in the past few weeks, as I have throughout the campaign. I see the trouble. I mean, these are places that desperately need jobs and economic growth, absolutely. And as governor, I'm totally committed to development of that area of the state. But how? Let's take a look at casinos first. I'm the only candidate for governor opposed to casinos and favoring the repeal initiative. I noticed this morning Elizabeth Warren joins me in this position. That's because of the information, the data. There are 39 states with casinos. We know what they do. Casinos destroy communities. Listen to me. They destroy communities. They kill small businesses around them. They add public safety hazards, drunk driving, and petty theft. They add gambling addiction to the areas they're in, and you have to then deal with gambling addiction and its consequences. Now, if you add all that up and you look at the jobs created in the casinos, which are, by the way, very low-income jobs when they're stabilized, $20,000, $22,000, $24,000 a year jobs, barely below the poverty line, barely above the poverty line for a family of four, their jobs killed. They're killed because gambling addicts lose their jobs, because small businesses shutter, and because money leaves the state. 90% of the revenue for casinos is slot machine revenue. It's $300,000 per year per slot machine. Think about what happens. You put your money in the slot machine. Where is that money going? Into the economy of Massachusetts? Absolutely not. That's going into the coffers of the big businesses that are now big lobbyists running casinos. So it's not a way to add jobs. It's an unhealthy way to add jobs. And they're predators on the poor. And poverty plagues us in the state still and in Springfield. Casinos are engineered to take money from people at low income.
Yeah, but Dr. Berg, if I just can on this, Don, the people of Springfield heard most of these arguments, maybe not from your lips at the time, when they decided, and they voted, despite those arguments, to say we want a casino in Springfield. It's sort of like if they elect a mayor and you don't like the mayor, you as governor don't get to decide that that shouldn't be the mayor of Springfield. If the people of Springfield democratically, after a passionate debate, say I want it, why shouldn't you defer to their judgment?
I understand that argument. 25% of the voters in Springfield did vote, and they split. I think it was something like 42-58.
Yeah, but so only 25% of people voted next Tuesday, and they picked you. You'd be willing to be the nominee,
that's
right?
Democracy at work. Okay. If the effects were just confined to Springfield, then we might have a strong argument in that direction. But they're not. This is a statewide effect. The gambling addiction, the public safety hazards, the problems of job loss, the problems of disruption of families that will occur. That's not confined to the boundaries of Springfield. This is a statewide decision. But let's go back to Springfield. In the interest of Springfield, I really want to help that city. And, you know, the public's going to have a vote, you know, on November 4th. I certainly hope the ballot initiative passes and the casinos don't come into this state. But let's talk about how to help Springfield. How about better infrastructure, roads and rail that serve that community? How about affordable housing housing development that people can actually find housing, not just in Springfield, but all over the state? How about investing in schools so they're in better relationship to businesses? I was told, I can't confirm this because I just was told it verbally, that there's a Chinese company considering coming into Springfield to build railroad cars, street trolley cars and things like that. What they're doing in advance is talking to the colleges around Springfield about the curriculum that would help prepare young people better for exactly those jobs. That kind of cooperative endeavor is great. How about innovation investments? The innovation economy works in Massachusetts. Relatively small amounts of public investment grow jobs. We've seen it in Greentown Labs in Somerville. We can see it in Springfield. And standing up for worker rights. Let me say a word about that. We need to help support economic growth by giving workers living wages, earn sick time. And making sure the gap between men and women, the income gap, closes. Money in the pockets of workers becomes money in circulation in the economy. And by the way, with respect to businesses and business development, one of my big agendas was at Medicare and Medicaid, and it would be as governor, simplification of the regulatory environment. I had a project when I was running Medicare. I called it the Stupid Regulation Project. Bottom line,
it's redundant, many people think, isn't it?
We ended up publishing regulation that took away 100 regulations because we didn't need them. I think we make this a great place for business and back to single-payer health care. You want to grow jobs, try that.
One last thing on a casino or gaming-related thing. The case can be made, and I think pretty convincingly, that if one of your major concerns about casinos is the predatory impact it has on low-income people in particular, all the studies I've seen say that a disproportionate share of the revenues is much higher from low-income people when it comes to playing the lottery.
That's correct.
Which we have very successfully, I use that in quotes, in the state because we return a huge amount of money to cities and towns. So if you're so troubled about casinos, why aren't you also campaigning to dump the lottery?
Well, I'm a realist, and we have the lottery, and almost $1 billion of revenue now comes through the lottery out to cities and towns which badly need support, and it's discretionary support. It really can be used the way the localities think about it. It would be very violent to back down from the lottery now. So here's my view of the lottery. It is regressive. It does redistribute money from the poor to the better off if you look at it overall. I think we need to manage the lottery in such a way as to try to mitigate that effect as much as we can. I'm opposed to the $30 lottery ticket. I could just imagine the families that are affected by that. We need some diligence here in dealing with the lottery and make sure it does the least possible damage. But look, we are where we are, and why dig the hole deeper?
Do you ever buy a ticket when it's a $300 million for Powerball? You have a smile on your face. The answer is yes,
I do. I argue to myself that money's going to some city or town somewhere and helping educate
children better. You got
to
go on the big ones. That's what I always say. You got to go on those. We're talking with Don Berwick, who's running for governor on the Democratic side. Dr. Berwick, you've been very progressive with progressives on immigration issues. You're in favor of in-state tuition and driver's licenses and stuff. And I know you were with Deval Patrick when he was talking about welcoming children who have been displaced from their countries into Massachusetts. But people in poor communities, we talked a lot about poor communities, in the Lawrences and the Lowells and the Lynns and the Brocktons and some of their leaders were freaking out, for lack of a better word, with worrying about what would happen when these kids, they didn't come, obviously, but what would happen with these kids coming into their school systems, because their school systems, particularly in a city like Lawrence, are largely full of immigrant kids already. This is not necessarily a prejudice thing, or it's not that we can't stand people from South America or wherever. It's because their child is already getting an inferior education, and now we're going to have 10 more kids in the classroom. So what do you say to those people with those legitimate concerns about their schools?
Well, I did not just agree with, but I applauded the governor when he made the decision to answer the president's call. These are kids in trouble, and I have trouble walking past someone in the street that we can help. And I think compassion is a good rule in public policy, just like it is in private life. And we weren't being asked to give away the store. This was a reasonable request, which we could have met reasonably. I think what's going on in the debate you're talking about, and I'm aware of it, is a myth that's been purveyed by very large concentrated wealth in this country whose interests are served by convincing us that it's a win-lose situation, that somehow we can pit the disadvantaged against each other or the disadvantaged against the middle class. That's a myth. It doesn't help anyone at all to have the kind of inequality that's now become rife in this country and afflicts our state. I think it's 34% of Latinos live below the poverty line. That's not going to change whether we have 2,000 kids who need help or not in this state. It is going to change when we have a governor and a government that says this is not right. We're a compassionate state organized around social justice and equality, and we need to really reach out to people of disadvantage of all types. Let's not buy the myth that helping some means you can't help the Commonwealth as a whole. And I would have an agenda for helping Lawrence and Lowell and the gateway cities of this community, of this Commonwealth, is stronger than any other candidate. I'm the one talking about ending poverty, ending hunger, ending homelessness in this Commonwealth. Just like I've set big goals in the rest of my career, I want to set goals around justice. And let's not buy into the win-lose vocabulary. I have great compassion to the people out there who are frightened by this, but what they're really being frightened about is big money, big wealth, and lobbyists controlling their futures.
Yeah. But in a practical matter, I mean, I'm a middle-class person. You're a middle-class person. I'm not going to have a first grader with 30 kids in the class in Lawrence, half of whom are English language second, whatever you call it. Their English is your second language kind of thing. That's a practical concern. Like right now in September, where the kids are already struggling, and I know you're okay with charter schools, but not that okay with charter schools. So,
Marjorie, we already have that problem. We have a highly diverse population in our public schools and in the lower income schools in lower income communities, much more diversity of language. We need to have English language learning and English supports to kids who can't speak English as their first language. We have 20,000 people in this Commonwealth waiting for English language learning opportunities. That includes people that are the entrepreneurs of the future. I learned that 60% of the new businesses in our Commonwealth are started by immigrants, first-generation immigrants. This is a nation of immigrants. That problem doesn't get worse by responding to the president's call for those kids. It gets worse when status quo politicians and business-as-usual budgeting and lobbyists who really want the money concentrated in other places like casinos or partners are taking the money away from the uses they need. I think we need to develop a more robust school system which invites people of linguistic diversity, cultural backgrounds that are different into our community. And those supports should be there.
We're talking to Don Berwick. He's one of the three people running for the Democratic nomination to succeed Deval Patrick. You know, the goal at a crowded advertising time is to have an ad on television that breaks through. I think the conventional wisdom is one of your ads has broken through. Here's a little piece of Don Berwick's ad.
Hey, want to play politics?
Yeah, I'll be Martha, you be Steve.
Gun lover, secret donors, NRA, super PAC.
Massachusetts, we're better than this. It's time to go in a new direction. The choice is simple. People who play politics.
Are two or not.
Or a governor who's a problem solver.
Isn't that a little bit of a cheap shot, though, Don? I mean, I watched the debate you did, I don't know when it was, in Western Massachusetts. And right after Steve Grossman, accused Martha Coakley of changing her position on something, you said, oh, there they go, sort of the Reagan-esque law, there they go again kind of thing. You did that at the beginning of this interview. I don't know what we were talking about at the top, but one of the first things you said was, well, that's a different position from, oh, Steve Grossman on the partners thing, a different position. It is a little bit of a cheap shot, isn't it?
No, it's not a cheap shot.
You don't think they're dedicated public servants, Grossman and Coakley?
They're fine people. They want to do the right thing. I don't have any quibble with them. That's a lighthearted attempt to point out something different, which
is
that these are inside politicians. These people have run 10 times for 6 different offices. They're wired into the lobbyists. They're wired into Beacon Hill. They have the political agenda of just getting elected is really high on their personal agenda. And I don't fault them from that. But is that what we need in the corner office? How about somebody that comes in with 30 years of experience as a leader, as an executive, someone who understands how to manage, and someone who's not afraid to put out some pretty bold goals, whether they play well initially or not? I didn't support single-payer health care because I had a poll in my pocket or because I tested the wins. I did it because you look at the numbers, you look at the data. It is the right thing to do. Is it easy? No. Is it popular? I didn't know. But I think we need to do it. Casinos, I'm not looking at the polls either way. Casinos are bad for this state. I'll say that no matter what the political winds say. And as far as fighting poverty, this myth that the fighting poverty hurts the middle class, it's infected our country, I will not stand for it. The middle class is not well served by having poor people suffering. It's not well served by 24,000 people in prison, half of whom don't need to be there, and $47,000 a year. It's not well served by having kids fail at school that we're under-supporting. How about someone in the corner office that just speaks their mind, isn't a politician, and knows how to manage? That's me. And the public's going to have a choice on September 9th. They can pick traditional politicians or they can pick someone with this kind of background and commitment. And that's what that ad says.
We're talking with Don Berwick, who's running for governor. What kind of manager has Deval Patrick been, the outgoing governor? A lot of his agencies, including the Department of Children and Families, were kind of falling apart under his management.
I think he's been a great governor. I think his leadership on matters of value, his commitment to clean energy, and we're really leading the nation now in the energy economy. He's truly tried to stick by schools. He has reached out to people of disadvantage. Just was looking the other day. I was in Holyoke at a group of people who are benefiting from his SSYI program. I think it's a Safe and Secure Youth mm-hmm. Initiative. I mean, this guy's been real. He's been there. But, you know, a serious background in management is rare in public life. Most people who get into office haven't had the advantage that I've had of actually having to grow and run organizations. I started an organization from zero. Today, 25 years later, it's worked in 70 countries. It's worked in every state in the union, 140 employees. We never laid off anyone, even during the Great Recession. I ran the largest agency in federal government, $820 billion a year budget. That kind of experience, including my experience teaching and practicing and learning modern approaches to quality management. That belongs in government and in our state government. And I think some of the problems we've seen of failures of cooperation among agencies, data systems that aren't serving people well, demoralized workforce in some cases, that goes back to whether you have an experienced manager doing a job that demands experienced management, like CEO of the state.
Isn't Steve Grossman's a pretty experienced manager, is he not? Is the difference because he didn't create Mass Envelope, as it was then called, as a family business? Or why should he not get credit for growing a business pretty dramatically, Don?
I did not inherit a business. I grew one. That's a different set of skills. And I've worked at a scale that I don't think Steve has. I've worked worldwide. I've worked with governments, with entire national health systems, with very large healthcare systems all over the world. And not only that, I've been teaching management. I learned and studied the modern methods of management that are called quality management or total quality management for workforce involvement, for good use of data, for constant innovation, for focusing on joy and pride in the workforce. I've worked all over the world on that, and I'll stack my experience up against Steve Grossman, Martha Coakley, and, by the way, Charlie Baker.
What's your website, Don Berwick?
BerwickForGovernor.com.
Great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
I hope you get to sleep a little bit between now and the primary. Only a week from today.
I'm looking forward to the primary day. It's my birthday, by the way, September
9th.
September 9th is my birthday.
My goodness. That could bring you some good luck. Don Berwick is a Democrat running for governor, and the primary is on his birthday, a week from today, September 9th. And by the way, I want to tell you your website again, BerwickForGovernor.com. And the final television debate is going to be this Thursday night. is going to be moderated by my co-host here, NACN's Jim Browdy, and simulcast here at 89.7 WGBH at 6 o'clock. Is that
correct?
At
6 o'clock, that is correct.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Burr, for being
here. Good to
see
you. Always fun. Thank you both.
Coming up, renting versus owning. It's not a debate about how to live. It's a debate about how to shop. From power tools to prom dresses, is borrowing better than buying? Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that discussion next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. If you're a part of yesterday's big move, there was probably a point where you vowed to never buy anything again. Nothing like moving day to bring you to terms with how much you own, and usually you come to the realization that you own too much. So, could renting things be a better alternative to owning them? Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about how borrowing is becoming the new buying is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration there. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there, Nancy.
Hey there, folks.
Hello, Nancy Kane. So please tell us why renting is becoming hot, 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 Nancy Kane.
So, again, I think we want to ferret out the, you know, journalistic exuberance, right, and search for a nifty story that always accompanies such fervor. But if we strip away a little bit of that, I think what's going on is that a whole plethora of businesses – so this is a force really on the supply side that's, if you will, galvanizing or instigating this trend. Everything from some business we've talked about like Airbnb or Uber or Lyft or Zipcar or – Rent the Runway, which we have not talked about, but it's a really interesting business. And it was founded, just for our good listeners, by Jennifer Fleece and Jennifer Hyman, two HBS graduates. I believe their class of 2009. I did not
2009?
Know. 2009? Yeah. Yeah.
This is where you rent an $8,000 wedding dress for $80 for Versace or something.
How brilliant, though. How brilliant is that whole idea?
Right. And you can rent the Versace gown or rent the Chanel bag or, you know, rent the extraordinary necklace and be all put together for several hundred dollars, right? And then it goes back to the warehouse and it goes get cleaned and fluffed and buffed and back out again. I should tell our dear listeners, just so we know, that it's never as simple as the headlines indicate, that Fleece and Hyman, the two entrepreneurs, very successful business, have opened one and soon to be two retail stores in Manhattan. So, you know, sharing and renting and online commerce are more complicated than we might think. But in any event, they're an interesting business. There's a great business that I spent a good half hour on the website on last night called Bag, Borrow, and Steal, I think. Forgive me, I'm not sure. I may have it quite right,
true.
But it's Rent the Handbag. And so you can rent a fabulous Chanel tote for $475 a month. And you can rent a really fabulous small, you know, Alexander Wang clutch for, you know, $175 a month and everything in between. They also have the option of buying again. So it's not all sort of straightforwardly and unabashedly, I must rent or die, as the newspapers would have us. But all these kinds of businesses, I even, on Chelsea Mertz, the fabulous producer of this show's recommendation, looked up renting a dog. So FlexPet, right, which is a growing business in the United States, will let you rent a dog again. It's a complicated kind of undertaking. You can think about the ramifications of that. But there's – and
– by the way, the Boston City Council, voted not to allow that business, if I remember correctly.
That's very interesting because in the
Boston
article I saw, they were talking about possibly opening in Boston and Washington, D.C., subject, I'm sure, to local restrictions and regulations. They're certainly in New York and Los Angeles. There's all kinds of restrictions, so all of us that love dogs more than life itself don't need to get our knickers in too much of a twist about this right now, because it's got lots of tight strictures on it, according to the article I read. The most interesting to me, and the most, if you will, emblematic of the trend that, you know, this New York Times article, by the way, is owning overrated? The rental economy rises, by Claire Kane Miller. The most interesting business here was renting tools. So hardware stores for years, decades have rented tools. But guess what? The average power tool in America is used for less than half an hour in its lifetime. So owning a power tool, owning lots of tools, particularly for those of us that aren't the handiest people on earth, makes a lot of sense. And there are lots and lots of places now, including dedicated online companies that will allow you to rent power tools. So what we're really talking about, I think, is on the supply side is a lot of interest in entrepreneurial interest and activity around being a middle person between the goods and the consumers and moving those goods back and forth and taking a hefty profit once you build the infrastructure. That's one thing we're talking about. Secondly, we're talking about, you know, the connectivity that we've talked about before when we talk about Airbnb or even eBay, which is really a pioneer in what we call the sharing or renting economy, right, that connects buyers and sellers in new ways. And now with smartphones, you can instantly say, hey, honey, let's fix up the garage tomorrow and put some shelves up. Let me rent a tool and you can have it in 2 days. So I think on the supply side, there's both technology, entrepreneurial activity, and viable business models, not in all cases, but in many of these cases, like Rent the Runway, that make it effective, make it interesting, make it attractive for businesses to get in to the renting and sharing game.
Where'd this start? When I was talking to Marjorie and Chelsea about it this morning, my sense was, maybe people won't even see this as renting. My non-thorough historical analysis was this started big time when you could download a book. I consider that being renting a book as opposed to owning it. When Amazon or whomever it was allowed you to download a book in a second, that was sort of the beginning of this
or
rental economy.
Or stream some music, right, where you don't own the album. You know,
where did this start?
I think of it with Zipcar.
Zipcar is a little bit later, started by a Cambridgeport parent, I should say.
So there's always been libraries, right? There's even been, you know, music lending libraries. So I think the concept of renting something or borrowing it for a while for a fee is not new. What is new is this idea that you can get all kinds of – you can convince people and people are interested in owning briefly or holding briefly all kinds of experiences and mostly goods. There's a lot of talk, dear listeners, about whether all this renting is emblematic of an experience-based economy. I think
especially expensive experience, right?
Right. I think that's poppycock. I mean, experience has always been a critical part of all kinds of consumption. So there's nothing really brand new there. But I think that the idea that this would become a much more commonplace occurrence for consumers and therefore for businesses really is based in the idea of online connectivity. Right. That's, you know, get on your phone, get the Zipcar, get the Uber car, rent the house in the south of France, get the tiara for the big event that you're going to at the Park Plaza. All of that, right, is really enabled and made more frequent and made much more both acceptable and intriguing by gotta have it now. And that's about smartphones. Right. That's about the internet and smartphones. So I think Zipcar is a great candidate. I think, you know, downloading a book is a great candidate. Those are streaming music is a version of this. In some sense, it's not brand new. It's part of a continuum of technology and consumer behavior morphing and changing in a way that has lots of roots in the past
And in the current, it seems to me. I mean, one of these articles we read this morning suggests that millennials are living in physically smaller space. And if you're living in smaller space, not only is it nice to rent a power tool that you're only going to use, would you say, for 30 minutes ever after you buy it for $190, but also if you have no place to put it.
Just like a Zipcar, right? I could not agree more. So my interest is always first and foremost on the demand side. You know, my work on entrepreneurship began on what was changing for consumers and how did entrepreneurs pick up on that, whether we're talking about lattes or, you know, rent a ball gown or, you know, Marshall Field creating this luxurious department store experience on the Chicago, you know, in the Midwest on the plains back in the 1860s. So I thought long and hard over the last couple of days about what is it on the demand side. So a piece of it is millennials and, as younger people often have, as urban dwellers always have, living in smaller spaces. I think there's a bunch of other interesting stuff, though. Another aspect is the incredible, if you will, expectation of consumers now at virtually all rungs of the socioeconomic ladder, save for the very poorest, that of course I can carry a Chanel bag. Yes. Right? I can have access. Yes. You know, and some of this is about the extraordinary prosperity globally. This is not confined to America. Globally, of the millennial generation. It is quite, there is nothing that compares to it in terms of a cohort in prosperity in the history of capitalism or in the history of childhood or in the history of parenting. It is simply, you know, unprecedented. So I don't think it's any surprise when you look at how so many kids have grown up, not only in terms of what they've had, but what they've had access to by virtue of smartphones and global connectivity and global brands that, well, you know, I'm 22 years old. I'm going to my first, you know, big college, you know, dance. By the way, that might be in Newport. I'd better have a, you know, I better have an Alexander Wang dress, or I better have a Pruenza Scholler, you know, handbag or clutch, and some Cartier jewelry to go with it. So,
by the way, if I knew what a Pruenza handbag was, I'd want Pruenza to rent Scholler. One. My no, guess but, is but
Nancy, very, very expensive. Okay.
Nancy
very, very
is
popular
so right design. About that, because I see that with my kids, and you
what?
See it with their friends, even kids that didn't come from lower middle class or working class, you know. Uh-huh. Background, they're going to go. Well, Victoria's Secret is not that expensive, but underwear is very expensive at Victoria's Secret.
They're going to rent underwear.
They're not going to rent it, no. But the idea that you would even buy it there, right, when you're not making a lot of money, it's expensive.
Right.
But that's kind of a birthright,
right? So aspirational consumption. We always talk about
that's
something you can aspire to, but we now have generations of people, and this, by the way, is not confined to millennials, that now have an expectation: I should have access. I can have access. I want access right now, right here and now, to that luxurious item. Right, or to that limo ride, whatever.
Right.
Choose your, or that house in the south of France at Airbnb, which I can get for, you know, $500 a night, where I could never afford to rent it for a week. So I think some of this is about expectation, rising expectations. A second aspect of this, so very much kind of nestled with, you know, incredible expectations of prosperity and the consumption that accompanies it, is a kind of, I've got to have it now. This impatience, the shortening of time frames and attention spans that is so much part of our modern life. I better have that handbag right here and now, right?
And I can't afford it right
I can't
now,
afford
but
it,
I can afford to rent it for a week.
Night.
Right.
And I'll get it. I'll pay the extra $27 to have it FedExed to me so I can have it tomorrow. You, by the way, that is not uncommon. So I think that some of this is about, I deserve it. I expect it, and I expect it now. And renting that, right, whereas, you know, layaway, if you go back to a very old, kind of now seemingly quaint way of financing consumer purchases, which was before mass credit cards, general credit cards, right, layaway was partly about that, but you laid it away and you didn't actually get the dress or the expensive handbag till you actually put all those installments of payments into the bank at whatever department store. That's all gone. I don't want to wait 3 months. I want it tomorrow. So some of this is about impatience and expectation and a kind of presumption. I'm not judging. I'm using the word in a more objective sense, a presumption that this is part of my life.
Can I come up with another
Absolutely.
Candidate for
yeah, sure.
Where this began? Forget yeah. Amazon.
Where?
When you mentioned, I don't know what you just mentioned, Nancy, the trigger that struck into Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School talking about the rental economy, renting versus owning. You know where it was? High school proms and tuxedos. Mm. Virtually every young girl
bought
a dress.
The dress.
Right,
I don't know that one single boy ever bought a tuxedo.
Right.
You went and you got measured. You had to return it within X number of days. And that was long before rental was big. So step back from this for a second. Are retail giants quaking in fear that as millennials become middle-aged, nobody's going to be buying virtually anything, and they're just all – they're essentially going to be renting almost everything?
I just don't see that at all.
Why?
Because
people want to own too? I mean, there's an internal conflict.
Well,
why?
A couple of data points. People want to own. People get accustomed to things. They want to have something. I mean, the interesting thing about all these websites is you can buy it, and you can buy the pet too. You can get none of them have the exclusion that you have to send it back. If you have the money or have the credit,
Understood.
Have a line of credit,
yep.
you know, MasterCharge or MasterCard will make it possible, and you can do it. The ownership is by no means over. Again, that's, I think, attention-grabbing headlines more than truth or more than reality. But there are other interesting evidence points, right? The idea that the possibility of owning all these things is so much part of this. Why would these very savvy women that run Rent a Runway open up retail stores? That's expensive. That's fixed cost.
Yeah.
That depends on ownership. Why would you do any of that if you really believed it was all about renting? retail, established retail players always have the option of playing on some of this, right? They can always, they have the logistics system set up. And the most expensive part of, about establishing these businesses, whether you're talking about renting ball gowns or renting pets, is establishing the infrastructure, right, to move the gowns in and out of post office boxes and FedEx boxes and to clients and to clean it and all that in between rentals. So all these players, established retail stores, have the option and have the infrastructure which they can leverage effectively or amortize, to use the financial term, to do this. So they always can pull that trigger or without the same kind of difficulty that startups have. I think that's another piece of it. I think there's something else as well, which is that retail is never solely about who has possession of the service or the good or the offering. I like
what does that mean?
Retail has always been about theater. I mean, Stanley Marcus, right, one of the man who really built Neiman Marcus into Neiman Marcus, understood this better than any other modern commentator. He said this, you know, years and years before online commerce had been so popular. He said people are never going to stop wanting to buy things and to go into stores, because a lot of what retail is, and this is why when we get something and own it, the glow fades so quickly, is we're not just purchasing the thing. We're purchasing the feelings that cluster in our hearts and heads about, oh, I really want to have this car, or, oh, I really want my latte this way, or, oh, I really, really want to buy that leather bicycle, you know, biker jacket. We're buying a piece of hope and ideas about ourselves and our place in society that we're always questing for. And the reason we, you know, there are many women like myself who own more than one, you know, zip-up jacket is because we are purchasing, and men have all of these kind of wishes too, so let's not make this a gendered discussion, is we're purchasing those kind of feelings and those kind of experiences. Going into a store in itself is part of that. So I don't think any of this is going away, and I don't think punching it into your phone and getting the box the next day on your doorstep is the whole enchilada. So if I were any big established player, I wouldn't be too worried about this. Last point, the coda to all this. If it's all about renting, then why isn't Amazon the leading player in renting anything? Because Amazon is, remember when we talked about Amazon some months ago and the gazelles, right? The gazelle being their code word for anybody they want to eat up and beat, you know, to a pulp in the marketplace. There have been few companies as aggressive, as opportunistic, as lithe ultimately, even though they spent and lost a ton of money building their infrastructure, as Amazon. If the Amazon fundamentally believed that retail and ownership were over, we'd be experiencing something very, very different when we logged onto their website, because Jeff Bezos wants to own the world, and he
doesn't want to rent it.
He doesn't want to rent it. He wants to own the world, and that depends on people wanting to buy things. So when Bezos exits all of what he's doing, right, online, then and sets up Amazon Rental, then I'm willing to revisit this kind of, if you will, prognosis about retail ownership
and the
future of commerce.
Nancy Kane, is this happening with ownership of like condos as well or not? Do we know? I mean, are people more into renting their little condos?
I got a quick one for you before she answers. Remember the great Barney Frank quote when he was chair of the Financial Services Committee? I've always said the American dream should be a home, not home ownership. Right. I mean, that is a variation, I guess, on this theme, right?
Well, I mean, so you have to be – the numbers there are not complicated, right? And they're very business cycle sensitive, right? The cycles of home ownership, whether we're talking about newly constructed homes, condominiums, or existing homes, we can track that. You know, the last 2 years have been overall, right, adjusted for small blips, have been overall all about exuberance at lots of price points, lots of income points in the socioeconomic ladder of people trying to buy their homes. Yeah. There are lots and lots of young people who might be traveling in Zipcar, but they're putting money away right now, right, to put a down payment on a home because they want to get in on the home ownership ladder early. Bully for them. I don't think we're going to be passing around homes in the same way we talk about vacation stays at Airbnb.
Nancy Kane, it's always fantastic to talk to you.
I love this topic.
I love it. I love it. It's really interesting. I love it, too. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership.
Good to see you, Nancy.
Up next, we're going to ask you guys about renting versus owning. Does the idea of doing away with your stuff and renting it instead appeal to you? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Ginn. If you're just tuning in, we were talking to Harvard historian Nance Kane about the trend towards renting versus buying. We mean renting things like a blender or a power saw or a wedding dress rather than buying one. Does this appeal to you? Are you practicing it? At 877-301-8970. Renting saves you money, obviously. It saves you space. It's probably better for the environment. Of course, owning something does give you a sense of freedom and independence. And if you want to make a set of bookcases at 3 a.m., which I'm always ready to do, nothing gets in your way if you actually own your power tools. Where are you on this renting versus buying thing? 877-301-8970. And again, almost all the literature suggests that it is generational, that it is primarily a function of the millennial generation and much less so a function of middle age or older people who are using the satisfaction of actually owning something still appears to be part of their genetic makeup. The number is 877-301-8970. Does this appeal to you?
Well, I would like to say, first of all, that I own my own power washer, and it's one of my favorite power
tools.
Yes,
washer?
I do. I get like $80.
That's embarrassing.
And it's not embarrassing.
Power washer?
Yeah, I have a power
washer.
It's
only $80?
And I really love it.
I'm going to come over and use it on myself later tonight.
Forget that. That's right. Hose you down.
Thank you.
You might fly from here to Brockton, though. They're pretty powerful things. Our number is 877-301-8970. Are you part of the rental economy or not? George says he wonders if the rise of the rental economy will help Beacon Hill be more open with rent a politician. What do you think, Jim?
I like that. I was thinking as Nancy was talking, I'm not exactly a clothes conscious person, but if I could rent most of the things I wear. One of our colleagues, Howard, is in the studio, is looking at me with, oh, really? In any case, Howard, thank you for that comment with your eyes there. If I could change my basic wardrobe every 3 months, mm-hmm. rent virtually everything for 3 months, and then do another round, doesn't that have great appeal? I mean, that is wonderfully appealing thing to me, to a person who's not anywhere near being a clothes horse or whatever that expression is.
You always make fun of me for wearing the same dress to every event.
Occasionally I do.
And this would
black one, it's very nice. It is nice.
That's right.
Statute of limitations is run on it.
Well,
though.
That's the thing, because if you get to be a certain age, you need to buy it. You can't go to TJ Maxx all the time. Well, maybe you can if you can get a great buy at TJ Maxx, but you feel like you have to have a nice dress for these nice occasions. But a nice dress is a lot of money. So if you want to just have a nice dress to wear once and have people think you have a nice wardrobe instead of showing up at every fancy event with the same dress over and over and over. I mean, this is perfect.
But there is a psychology. I was trying to express this to Nancy at the end there, and I can't, but I couldn't articulate it well. There is a certain satisfaction about actually owning something, and maybe because that's what the ethic has been for decades and decades. But it is liberating. The notion, I have so much clutter. You've seen my car. I mean, I have owned so much crap that I am the perfect. When she was describing, what did she say? Nancy say the average power tool is used 30 minutes in its whole life when owned by an individual. I am that person. I buy so many things, not wildly expensive things. I use them once and I never use them again. So you would think that I'd be the perfect person to engage in this rental economy. It really does have great appeal.
Well, I think it's got great appeal about clothes, particularly if you're a woman, because men can wear the same suit over and over and over again and nobody ever cares.
Does that mean that to the next major event there may be a different dress? No, I'm just asking. I'm not being critical.
I think I may break out of the mold, Jim, and get a different
dress. Is that Marjorie Egan and that Versace over there?
That's right. You know, who's going to go out and buy a Versace unless you're really loaded? You're not. But if you could rent one for one night for $150.
Listen.
Of course, it does seem a lot of money for $150, because then you have to rent the bag to go with it.
It's a lot less than $10,000, isn't it?
Before you know it, you're up to $400 for a single night. Maybe I'll just wear the same.
877-301-8970. Renting versus owning.
Maggie from Sharon. What do you think about this, Maggie?
Hi.
Hi. I feel like most people are looking to rent rather than own now because there's a lot of liability, a lot of insurance, a lot of things that you can lose when you actually own something.
Like what? Like jewelry? Like what are you talking
about?
Like
a house. Like a lot of people are renting houses more than looking to own one because there's the property tax and then you have to pay for electricity and water and heat and it accumulates. And, you know, where our generation mostly is now paying monthly in smaller increments rather than saving to own that big thing.
What is our generation, Maggie?
Well, I'm 25.
Oh, well, that's you're a millennial.
What is it, the X generation?
Well, millennials.
You're millennials.
Generation
millennials,
X, whatever.
Yes.
And is it part because of the debt? I mean, we've talked a lot on the show, and everybody in America has talked about things like college debt. Is it because of debt or just because it's a simpler way of living?
You know, it's a combination of both because you come out with all the student loans, and that's the biggest problem is paying back school.
We know that.
Prevents you from owning things and putting something towards that because you're trying to pay off your education.
But is there, before we let you go, Maggie, since you're in that demographic group, are there certain things that you say, I really want to possess? I really want to own this thing so it stays with me? Or is that not part of your thinking at all?
You know, honestly, it's not at all. I kind of have the attitude where I don't want to own anything.
Got it.
I, you know.
Maggie, you said it well. Thank you so much. There's a full participant in the renting economy, Marjorie.
Rachel from Newton. What do you think about renting versus owning, Rachel?
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Great.
I love the idea. I actually just had this conversation with a friend of mine who is from the Dominican Republic who's getting married. She lives in America now, but she said to me that there, no one ever buys their wedding dresses. They all rent their wedding dresses. And
really?
I just thought it was a brilliant idea. It's just in their culture, it's perfectly acceptable to, you know, rent a beautiful brand new gown, you know, and then return it after. And they save so much money. And I just thought it was such a great idea. Just thinking back on all my friends that have spent so much money on gowns.
Well, you know what I've seen, too, is these places like Anthropology are starting to sell wedding dresses that are much, much cheaper. Like they're $800 or $700 instead of like $4,000. But, I mean, would you want to go out and spend $4,000? Are you married?
Or $8,000.
Rachel?
Or yeah.
I am married, and I happened to buy a beautiful vintage gown because that was what I was into at the time.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I didn't spend more money on it because it's been just stored away in a box. It's never seen the light of day since.
Exactly.
Also, you know, I'm so glad you said that because the only thing I've ever heard productive about a multi-$1,000 wedding dress is maybe your kid wears it in 30 years.
Right.
But I would argue that that is far less of a benefit than the benefit of not spending the thousands of bucks. Rachel, I'm sorry.
Right. Well, and I just want to add, most of the time, you know, you think you might pass it down to your daughter, but your daughter may have completely different
style. And then feel compelled to wear it because the mother says it matters a lot to her.
Yeah.
And you know what you could do?
Right.
You could also rent another dress 30 years later and tell her that's the one you wore at the wedding. How's she going to know?
Exactly.
Rachel, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
877-301-8970. We're talking the rental versus the ownership economy. Cheryl is on the phone from Boston. Hi, Cheryl.
Oh, this is Cheryl Marshall, isn't it, Cheryl?
Hi, Marjorie and Jim. How are you?
Oh, hello, Cheryl.
Hi,
Cheryl Marshall. How are you?
I'm great. I'm a little hot, but I'm great. Are you wearing rented clothes today?
No, but we will be tomorrow.
Just checking. Well, you know, you're talking a lot about the millennials, and Professor Kane was talking a lot about the millennials and the demand side. Let me just spend 2 minutes on the supply side, where you're finding a lot of the boomers participating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an Airbnb, home away, and home exchange. And these have been phenomenal. You look and you say, hey, why should I, you know, spend money on rent in Martha's Vineyard for the month of August when I can trade my, you know, beautiful home and wherever and go for free? Or, you know, I can go to Martha's Vineyard and not have to pay any fees to realtors or to hotels and find somebody who owns a place and negotiate a price through Airbnb. A huge amount of millennials, excuse me, boomers. I'm getting them mixed up, maybe because I want to be millennial.
Hey, Cheryl, you're talking to one right now who's done it many a time on the Cape in New York City.
Right.
It's huge.
Right. It's huge. I couldn't get a hotel. My kids live in New York. I couldn't get a hotel room once. Went right to Airbnb. Price was great. Room was great. My husband and I did a phenomenal exchange in Florida for a couple of years. And this is a big part. I don't talk to many boomers who are not doing this.
Wow. So it's across the board, is bottom line, is what you're saying, Cheryl.
Well, certain things.
I'm renting a power tool. I'm too old.
Yeah. Would you rent a Versace gown, Cheryl, for a night in the town?
Probably not, Marjorie. If you remember, I was a major filings basement shopper. We'd probably be scouting. You know, I might be scouting the consignment shops for one.
Okay.
I'm glad you said what you said, Cheryl Marshall, because Marjorie and I bought you a power tool for your birthday. So.
Oh, thanks.
Hey, Cheryl Marshall, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
I think there are certain power tools you use a lot. What about hedge clippers? That's a power tool, isn't it?
Well, I guess, yeah. You mean the
obviously
electric. Like a
drill,
saw
electric
or
drill?
A drill. Yeah. Or that's, but there, a lot of them, drills are really cheap these days.
I spend
days.
A lot of time drilling around the house.
You do? Okay, fine, Marjorie. Let's move
not
on.
Not really. Sam from Wellesley.
Hey, guys.
Oh, my God. Go ahead, Sam. Yeah, how are you? Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Sam.
Thank you. How are you guys? Great show, by the way.
Thank you kindly. We appreciate it.
So I just want to talk about a little bit different, not the dress or the housing, but more around, you know, I do a lot of photography, you know, professional, and I think my economic decision has been always not to own all the lenses. They're going to be very expensive. Each lens can cost up to, you know, $2,000. Mm. So typically, you know, you own a couple of them that you use a lot, but some of the lenses you just rent, which is very easy to rent online. And even there are stores actually in Newton, you can actually walk in and rent.
You mean for a specific job kind of thing?
Correct.
Yeah.
Specific job, right? If you're going for example, a landscape, you need a certain kind of lens, and you don't want to own it for, like, you know, for one job. So you just go rent it and use it and return it. I think it's a great way of doing things.
Hey, it sounds absolutely fantastic. How much money did you save, do you think, Sam?
Sorry?
How much money do you think you saved doing it that way?
Oh, so for example, a lens which can cost you, like, you know, $3,000 to just buy it for a weekend, it'll cost you like $40-$50.
Okay. That's pretty convincing, Sam. Thank you for the call.
Sam, thanks for the call. You know, by the way, this is one of these things that makes so much sense that you say to yourself, why haven't you been doing it? I don't mean you. Why hasn't one? Why haven't I? Why haven't you been doing it? It makes total sense.
It does. Well, there's a certain laziness. You know, you just don't want to be bothered. You just want to wear the same dress over and over again. Listen to this from Linda. She says she's one of the best dressed women in her circle. After a few wearings, she sells her expensive items to the garment district. It's not renting, but it's sort of an idea about how to make some money on the stuff that you
garment district is a great thing. But also, you make short money. It's not exactly like you're selling it for close to the price.
Well, she's probably not selling a Versace gown to the garment district. But there are these high-end secondhand stores.
I know that very well.
They have beautiful clothes.
877-301-8970. Briefly, what we're talking about, we spoke with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School a few minutes ago about this trend. She doesn't think it's going to totally take over, but particularly amongst millennials, to rent things, every kind of thing, as opposed to buying it.
Dan in Boston, what do you think, Dan?
I actually, my wife and I, we live in Boston. We can't afford to really buy, but we can afford to rent where we want to live. We live in Fenway, love the neighborhood, but yep. I can never afford one of the houses. And then also, if something ever breaks down, I'm not calling Sears. I'm calling my landlord. My landlord has to call Sears and get that fixed for us.
That is
a
great appeal.
But, Dan, one of the things I'm always afraid of, would be afraid of, is that the rent would just keep going up and up and up and up. And then you get to be like 50 or 60 or something. And what are you going to do then?
It has gone up and up and up. It's just, you know, you kind of hope and pray that you're paycheck goes up and up and you can afford to keep paying the rent.
The answer is you moved to Fitchburg, Dan. I believe that's what the answer Marjorie was looking for.
Yeah, but you know,
we live in Fenway. We even rent a garden plot in the Fenway Garden Association. So, I mean, we have a yard and I don't have to pay sales tax.
Oh, my
that is great.
Okay.
I have a garden.
How much
I love
does it
that.
Cost you to rent the garden? Just curious, Dan.
It's $30 a plot and my wife and I have a double plot. So it's $60 for the entire year.
Wow.
And it's bigger than my apartment.
That is... Dan, you're a great caller. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. What are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at the emails. We have one thumbs down from Mel. He says he wants to own things. No one's focusing on the negative ramifications of this on the economy. As for Airbnb,
What are the negative ramifications?
Well, I think he thinks what you were worried about with Nancy, this is going to hurt the retail market. She says it's not.
Yeah, but let's assume it did hurt. If it hurt the retail market, it isn't like it wasn't going to help something else. Then obviously businesses that rent things would explode and retail would recede a little bit. It isn't that people are still going to buy things or – I don't mean buy things. I mean get things, obtain things, whether they rent them or they purchase them. So it's a changing economy. It doesn't – I don't think it's a frightening thing at all.
Paul from Somerset. What do you think, Paul?
Hey, Paul.
Hi. Well, I would definitely describe myself in the millennial generation, and I would also describe myself as a minimalist or someone who attempts to live, you know, with that mindset in mind. And there's certain things you want to purchase, like a home, you know, for long-term wealth-building goals.
Right.
But there are other things that you don't need all the time, like tools or a wedding dress, that they need to be in your life for a short amount of time, and then you don't need them around cluttering up your space. So there's certainly power in having just the right amount of stuff and not having excess.
Give us an example, Paul, of the last couple of things you've rented rather than purchased.
Gosh. So power tools, for instance, I had to sand and stain my deck. And, you know, I focused on just seeing of my friends who I could borrow things from and what I had to go to Home Depot and rent. And I got the job done for, you know, a fraction of the cost, you know, to buy that stuff and you know, invest that way.
And part of your thing is, as you say, you want to keep things simple and avoid clutter. See, that to me, the avoiding clutter thing is a colossally appealing thing. Paul, thank you for your call. Doesn't that there's no appeal to that? The cleanliness of it, the streamlined nature of your existence, not having to have all these things around that you know you have no intention of ever using again in your whole life, no?
You never know. You might get the urge, Jim, to go out and do a little power sanding on the back deck. You know what I'm saying?
And by the way, that's another good example. We're talking about the genesis of this. You remember when people when they sand floors. Remember when wood floors were really huge? They're still big, but there was an era 15 years ago maybe when everybody wanted wood floors. Well, if you did it yourself, which is the biggest mistake in the world, by the way, but if you did it yourself, you went out and rented a sander.
Right.
You didn't go buy a sander. Why? Because you were only going to use it once. There, it was obvious that that was the case, as opposed to what Nancy was talking about, is we convince ourselves that we're going to become carpenters at home, and we buy this stuff, and then it collects dust in the basement.
So floors were the big thing 15 years ago. What's the big thing now?
What do you mean? What is the big thing
you
that people want
to
do?
Floors used to be big. That wood floors used to be big. That means they're not big anymore.
No, I think they're still big, but they're not big. Looking for apartments or to buy places, you know that one of the things that everybody wanted, do they have wood floors? Wasn't that what people said in that day?
Well, and I'm asking what they say now.
Did they say?
Yeah.
I want a Versace dress. That's what most of them...
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not an anthropologist.
No, I thought you had some
sociologist
thing. Maybe we
I have nothing.
Maybe we want linoleum floors now through the whole apartment. I don't think so. That would be really
horrible.
You know,
just for a second, I'm sorry. When I see a man in an incredibly expensive, beautifully tailored suit
I
could never afford,
you
say to yourself,
how much it must have cost.
And I didn't mean that. But how much would you like to wear that and have the feel of all that? That has colossal appeal to me, which, again, until the discussion with Nancy today, I never would have thought of.
You know something, though? There's a gender issue here.
What do you mean?
I think a woman could get away with renting the Versace gown to go to some big event at the Park Plaza like Nancy Kane was talking
about. But what?
I don't know if you'd feel the same way about a man who rents a suit.
But, Marjorie, I don't think you have to wear a label on your Versace or on your $4,000 suit saying, rent at Joe's, return by midnight tomorrow.
Know.
I think it's between you and the rental establishment.
Imagine people know, like you get these big debates coming up, Jim, if you were wearing a rented suit. That would be bad.
I'm actually contemplating doing it, to tell you the truth.
I don't think.
I have no intention of disclosing it.
Yeah, I don't think you should do that. I think it would be a bad thing. Do we have time for one more call?
One more last quick one.
Okay, let's go to Greg in the car. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Greg.
How you doing? Jim, earlier you said about you buy a tool and then use it once and never use it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in my mid-50s, and as I got older, I realized I was doing the same thing. So now if I need a special tool, I usually go to Home Depot, use the tool, and then I bring it back.
You're a little ahead of the rental economy, Greg.
And then you can do the same thing. One time I needed to make falafel. I didn't have a fryer, so I went to Walmart and I bought a fryer. Used it, then I cleaned it up, brought it back.
Greg, you are so my kind of guy, Greg. I can't even tell you. Thank you for the call.
And he's not the only one. How many times have you heard stories about high school girls that rent these, buy these prom dresses and wear them once and bring them back and put the labels inside when they go to the prom? You're not supposed to do that, by the way. Just want to be clear, Greg. I think that's against the law, isn't it?
It may be.
We'll have to ask the Attorney General.
Ask the Attorney General, I was just going to say.
Masters, because she's coming up next. Attorney General Martha Coakley joins us, and we wind up our final round of interviews with the gubernatorial candidate. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Regan here with us in Studio 3 for her final interview as a gubernatorial primary candidate before next week's September 9th vote is Attorney General Martha Coakley. Attorney General, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. We're going to see you Thursday night, though.
Yes, we'll indeed you are.
Yeah.
That's right.
Final televised debate.
The debate, and it's going to be televised, simulcast, I should say, live here on WGBH.
And
so
we look
exciting.
Forward
GBH
to
radio.
It.
So
it
do we.
Great. GBH
Thank
Radio, that's
you.
Right, 89.7. So, Attorney General Martha Coakley, the Boston Globe said that you hadn't fully explained why you want to become the next governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So if they missed it, tell our listeners, why do you want to become the next governor of Massachusetts?
Sure. So I've been talking to voters, knocking on doors, and talking to folks across the Commonwealth since last September. And what I hear from them and what my message is that they just want a fair shot. They want us to turn this economy around for everybody, not just Wall Street, not just people at the top, and frankly, not just Boston and Cambridge, that we need to have a regional economic development plan, which I enrolled last week, that will put money into the 13 sections of the state. We'll focus on our academic centers, on returning some precision manufacturing to parts of the state, looking at smart farming, depending upon the region, working to invest in schools, workforce development, making sure that we roll out a red carpet to businesses and cut red tape. And I believe that we've got the infrastructure here to do this. I think we've done a lot of work under Governor Patrick on investing in innovation and infrastructure in education. If we continue that and we do it in the right way, we'll have smart growth across Massachusetts. And I think that we can be prosperous and fair here in Massachusetts.
Can we talk about my favorite topic, Martha Coakley? One of my favorite topics.
Yeah, you don't only have one, Jim.
That's exactly right.
You have more than one.
Let's talk casinos for a second. You've made it clear that you're going to vote against repeal on November 4th, I guess it is. But you've said in the last couple of weeks that should the law be repealed, that you would, quote, keep an open mind as to whether or not a separate legislation should be filed to allow the Springfield to build its casino. It's sort of Charlie Baker's position is he will file such a thing if the law is repealed and he's elected governor. Your view is you keep an open mind. Don Berg was here about an hour ago and said the impact of a Springfield casino isn't just in Springfield, even though the people voted for it there. It spills over into surrounding communities. So if the voters of the Commonwealth speak, why should you not fully honor their mandate?
Well, I think, look, we're talking about democracy, and one of the great things about this statute that the legislature passed was that it did give people local control. It let organizations come to communities and talk about what they might do or not do. I know that Springfield has voted to do it. They're excited about doing it. I haven't made any promises, but I think any governor has to keep an open mind about where we're going forward. It may all be moot if it's not repealed, and if it is, that's all I said, is I would keep an open mind, as I will on many issues. I think it's important that we continue to look at and assess economic development and the pros and cons of any program going forward.
Let's stay with this just for a second, though, if we can. The people of Plainville also voted in favor of the slots parlor, and that's going ahead. People in Revere and Everett voted for a casino. One of them is probably going to get an award, maybe as early as right after the primary. Would you keep an open mind, even if it's repealed? If you're going to keep an open mind for Springfield, would you keep one for Plainville? Would you keep one for Everett or Revere, whoever gets the Eastern Massachusetts casino? And if not, why not?
Well, I think we need to see what that vote is, Jim, and how extensive it is. And I'm interested in the discussion. We're going to have this argument this fall about what it means and what people really want. And we've gotten, you know, there are times when the legislature wanted it, didn't want it, the governor wanted it. I just said we have been through a lot of investment in the state to, if we were going to go forward. And I've said it's not the first place I would go for economic development. Don't get me wrong. That's why I moved to have a money laundering statute. Why we've had a tough regulatory and enforcement regime. I talked to the AGs in Nevada and in New Jersey. I know that there are huge issues moving forward with this, but at this stage, we put some investment into a statute and moving forward. And look, I think it's fair to say, let's see what happens in November.
We're talking with Attorney General Martha Coakley, and the primary is a week from today. And she, of course, is running on the Democratic side to become the next governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. You know, the front page of the Globe today, not to keep mentioning the Globe, but they had a story about health care costs.
You work there now. I would keep mentioning if I were you.
We used to hear a lot about the Herald, it seems to me.
It's amazing how things have changed.
That's right. I've switched allegiances here. The Globe had the front page story today about health care costs going up in Massachusetts. And two of the prime people that they blame for the health care costs going up are Blue Cross and Partners. Doesn't this make us a little bit more nervous about the agreement you've made with partners to expand? It's been criticized on many fronts. You know, Don Berwick, Jim just mentioned him. He said you gave away the store on this one, allowing partners to expand these three South Shore hospitals, even with the caveats.
Absolutely not.
Okay,
and,
why not?
And particularly because we know that healthcare costs are going up. We know that those hospitals are expensive. It's precisely the reason that we did our healthcare policy reports that we did. It's precisely why we've entered into this agreement now that puts restraints on partners and their growth. It keeps their cost down and actually changes the playing field right away for consumers and for the other competitors. And so this was something I worked with Department of Justice and for 4 years in our office. I will stand by this deal as one that is in the best interest of consumers and healthcare here in Massachusetts, including that we have good access and we have good quality healthcare. And so I know we've got work to do. I know we've got to keep costs down. But it's precisely why this kind of agreement is a much better result. And I'll stand on that.
Have you, Steve Grossman has said he'd at least consider a single payer option. I think those are the words he's used. You have not. Is this something you oppose for the state?
No, and I've said this because Dr. Berwick, and I respect Dr. Berwick a lot. He's a very thoughtful guy. I know he cares passionately about this issue. He's a terrific doctor. But I have said that idea of single payer is it's a remedy among other remedies. It's a way we pay for something. I've said I haven't ruled it out. I've said we're not ready to do it yet. We still have a lot of work to do here to make sure that we accomplish what we need to, which is continue to provide access, move out to community health care, making sure we don't bake in inequities here in terms of who's expensive and who isn't, and making sure that we provide good quality care for people.
Can we discuss another deal, Martha Kulig? We're talking to the Attorney General who is running for the Democratic nomination for governor. That, of course, is next. I should say, of course, that is next Tuesday.
A week from today. Don't forget to vote.
Thank you. What did you say? You want to tell the truth, Marjorie? What did you say this morning before we came on the air?
I said it was 9 days, the primary.
And I said if you were smart, you would tell Berwick and Grossman supporters. I don't need to give you advice.
Nobody told Marjorie there'd be math.
That's right. That's right. I was in the right month anyway.
Martha Kulig, let's talk about another deal you recently negotiated. This is with a Brennan firm, former state legislator. He was a lobbyist for, and you'll correct my facts if I get some of them wrong, a lobbyist for the Franciscan, wonderful operation, on a contingency basis, which my understanding is illegal in terms of lobbying, took $370,000 in fees. You negotiated a deal to get $100,000 back for the Franciscan, which is returned to them. I have to say, I was deluged by some of your supporters arguing why, and you'll make the case in a second, it was a good deal. And so then it's predictable that the Grossmans and others would criticize you. Your former deputy, who is a huge Martha Kulig fan, Maura Healey, said the deal didn't go far enough. So while your opponents have a good reason to criticize you, if Maura Healey says he didn't go far enough, isn't there some concern there? Shouldn't there be some concern there?
Well, first of all, let me just say that we handle cases like this and have for the last 8 years. The hospital came to us with a set of facts and a situation. We looked at it and we believed, and I'll stake, you know, all of the work that we do and the transparency on this, on the fact that we believed still, and I believe today, that getting $100,000 back to Franciscan Hospital that treats some of the toughest cases of children who have been neglected, abused, who have physical and other health disorders, that was the best result that we could get. It was an old case. There were statute issues. There were legal issues. Look, I'm not afraid to go after anybody that I can hold accountable, but my job is always as Attorney General and as governor will be to get the right result for the Commonwealth. So it was the right response. It was the right result. I'll stand on that. And all I will say is, not everybody had all the facts here. I think, admittedly, even in some of the comments that criticize it.
So that includes Maura Healey?
Yeah. She didn't have all the facts.
We're talking with the Attorney General of the Commonwealth, Martha Kulig. You know, immigration is always a hot button issue in Massachusetts, and you have now said that you're open to issuing driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants, and this is a reversal from what you thought before. So what's the change? Why did you change your mind on this?
Well, I had opposed it, and I've acknowledged that. We've talked about this a lot on this show, actually. You know, there was a time when we were all hopeful that the federal government would do what it's supposed to do, reform immigration. I've supported a DREAM Act for a long time. What we've seen is the abysmal failure of Washington to reach any resolution on a very important issue now has left the states up to fend for themselves. And so I know my colleagues in other states and governors in other states have looked at how do we provide for people who are living here, working, paying taxes, and what do we do since Washington has left us without a solution? What I've said is that I would appoint a director of immigrant and community safety as governor to make sure that we are hearing from our mayors, our police departments, our communities, and make sure that we can work with the federal government on these important issues of people who are actually living in our communities now.
Why are you still, you said, what did you just say, I'm open to the notion of doing driver's licenses? What argument is there against doing assuming the feds aren't going to do anything, at least for the time being, and even if the president issues an executive order, it's not going to cover this, like least likely won't. Why wouldn't we want people, whether they're here legally or not, if they're going to drive anyway, and they are, why wouldn't we want to know where they are, want to guarantee that they're insured, guarantee that they had some training before they got a license? What argument is there against this?
Well, I think you've just made all the arguments for it, obviously. But keep in mind, and this issue comes up now as we look at the Real ID legislation at the federal level, that the driver's license is your basic identification that allows you access to many services, federal authorities, et cetera. It has been the primary way that we identify people. And I have thought in the past that in the statute proposed provides for a separate license, not a regular
message. It would look different or say something different.
Yeah, it would look different. And so that's why I've said, you know, I've talked to a lot of folks who say, you know, my child was sick or I need it to work. And so there's a real pressing issue for people. And that's why I've said, let's look at what other states are doing. Let's look at what makes sense here. And that's why I would move forward to at least look at the issue and see what we do or don't do, particularly in light of no action in Washington.
We're talking with Martha Coakley, the Attorney General. You know, I was up at the Democratic Convention and heard you talk about, you know, why you should be the nominee and saying that you knew a lot of people were disappointed that you lost in 2010 to Scott Brown. And there were a million stories written, and it was like you were running for president because it was everywhere around the country, Saturday Night Live, et cetera. You still hear people talking about this today. Do you still get asked about the Scott Brown race all the time? It seems to me it was 4 years ago. It's done. But just at the news meeting this morning, someone mentioned, oh, Martha Coakley had lost to Scott Brown in 2010, and a lot of women were upset about that. Do you still get asked about it? And if women are upset, what do you tell them?
I think there were a lot of people upset, rightfully so. Look, we all mourn Ted Kennedy's loss, and we mourn the influence that he had for this state in Washington. You know, we have two great senators now, but he had enormous seniority and enormous empathy for people here in Massachusetts. So that was a huge loss. I've acknowledged that. I've addressed it, you know, on the road at the convention. I hear it a lot less. I mean, people are always going to bring that up. A lot of people who don't pay close attention don't realize I got right back to work as Attorney General. I ran statewide. We've done great work keeping people in their homes, challenging the Defense of Marriage Act. So I'm proud of my work. I've acknowledged that we made mistakes. And frankly, I think that it has helped me be a better candidate this time around, understanding that people want to see you. They want to hear you. We've spent almost every day since last September on the trail, shaking hands, meeting people, listening to people. I understand that people feel they didn't get that in a very short special election, and they were disappointed by the loss. So I said, if I'm going to run for governor, I'm going to get out there and make sure that people get to see me, know what I've done, but more importantly, what I can do as governor, and how excited I am about being able to turn this economy around for everybody, not just people at the top, not just Wall Street. And look, they know I have the credentials of standing up to Wall Street, making sure that we brought money back into the state to keep people in their homes. We saved 30,000 people from foreclosure. We have families now that are families because we challenged the Defense of Marriage Act. The work I've done as AG, I'll continue to do as governor, standing up for people, making sure we invest in good education, our workforce development, making sure kids get our computer science that they're going to need to compete. And I can't tell you, I'm excited about the race. People, I know a lot of folks think, oh, no one's paying attention. People are paying attention. I see it and hear it every day when I'm out talking to folks.
You remember my spot-on prediction after you lost to Scott Brown. I said that she would never run for re-election as Attorney General. I'm quite proud that I really was on. You know, just for a second, it wasn't
once
on our
again,
list
of, Jim, you were right on the money.
Thank you very much. Just on this DOMA thing, we were talking to Sue O'Connell from Big Windows the other day about the likelihood of the Supreme Court getting a case very soon on the larger issue of gay marriage. Are you nervous, as somebody who's been intimately involved in these issues for years, are you nervous that the time is not right and the Supreme Court could issue a decision that could actually be a setback after a huge number of victories in state after state after state?
I am not, and I'll tell you why. This is one issue where, because I think of the great work that the advocates for marriage equality have made, not just in Massachusetts, but around the country, and the recognition, even in states that you would think would never see this, in a short period of time, every single federal court has said, you know what, this is a civil right. This is something that we recognize, and that people really support it. The level at which public support for this, this is one instance where I think public support has been way ahead of the courts, but the courts recognize that. And as a legal matter, when you really look, as we did when we challenged the Defense of Marriage Act, you asked a question earlier, well, how could you not support it? You can't make one good argument as to why we shouldn't allow for marriage equality.
You know, Martha Coakley, if you become the governor of the Commonwealth, this you won't be able to Tsarina-like make this rule, but you've been a prosecutor your whole life, Middlesex County District Attorney, tried a lot of cases. We possibly have the trial of the Tsarnaev brothers, not brothers, there's only one left, but the remaining younger brother, Tsarnaev brother, if there is indeed a trial. You've had cameras in the courtrooms and state courts for quite some time. Would you be willing to push for cameras in the courtroom if you're the governor of the Commonwealth, if it means for this trial in particular, hundreds of people that were affected by this having to physically come to a courtroom and then be in the overflow room because there's not enough room in the courtroom to see this trial? Basically, I'm asking about cameras in federal courts, which are now not there. And they weren't there for the probation trial, and they weren't there for the Sal DiMaci trial either.
Well, or the Bulger trial.
Or the Bulger trial,
or any
that's
federal
right.
Trials. That's right. You know, if it's not just the governor, at the state level, we have little, as you know, or no influence. I can speak to my experience that I've tried many cases where the camera's in the courtroom, and the Woodward case, many cases.
Were you performing for the jury?
Absolutely not. And let me tell you what happens, though, when you're trying a case. You're working for the jury, and you forget. It's kind of like the lion tamer in the ring. I heard a guy say, someone said, aren't you worried about all the people in the audience? And he said, no, I'm just worried about the lion when I'm in the ring. And you're worried about the judge and the jury, and you pay attention to that. And I know, having tried weeks-long cases, that as long as you have good reporting and you have, you know, gavel-to-gavel coverage, not just cutting in, the real issue around camera coverage is the talking heads. People who come in as if it's a football game said, oh, the defense just made a good point. But that's a separate issue from what you've raised, Marjorie. And, you know, whether federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, by the way, no cameras in the courtroom, no buffer zone for them, but they make the rules for everybody else. And so whether or not the federal government will ever allow that, I don't know. But I think that if you have good prosecutors, good defense counsel, they focus on that jury.
So you think from your opinion, it would be okay to have cameras in the federal
yes.
courts?
Okay.
Back to politics for a couple of seconds, Martha Coakley. The poll that came out in the Globe last week, which for the first time showed Charlie Baker in a dead heat with you, actually up 1 point, but within the margin of error. I have to say, I was not that surprised because you've obviously been the subject of attacks in a primary, unlike what Baker has been. What did surprise me was the number which suggested of Grossman's supporters, 48% of them, if he were not in the race, said they'd vote for Charlie Baker, and only 28% would vote for you. Now, obviously, your hope is to be able to fix that, and the assumption is if you win the primary that there'll be a unity thing. But does that, even at this stage, does that not concern you? That seems to be a pretty large number. Almost half of Grossman's supporters say they'll support the Republican.
Well, Jim, you're looking at that sort of crosstabs argument. The number of people is pretty small, but that aside, I think what you're really talking about is trying to get information in the middle of a, you know, pretty aggressive primary. People are supportive of their candidates. We welcome that. We've got, as I said, three great people running for governor. Democrats are lucky in Massachusetts. Great people running for governor. Great people running for the other offices. So people get involved in their candidate. And so, look, I believe, regardless of what anybody says, on September 10th, all the Democrats are going to have a great coordinated campaign. And I know I'll be there on September 10th, regardless of who wins. We know we need a Democratic governor to make sure that we turn the economy around for everybody. Look, I came in, you know, to clean up the big dig. We know Charlie Baker played a big role in creating that. I'm working now on keeping health care costs down after Charlie Baker was involved in allowing Mass General and Brigham and Women's to join, to become partners.
You don't think he deserves credit for his rescue work at Harvard Pilgrim?
I didn't say that he doesn't deserve credit, but I think we've got to look at the whole record about what the two candidates, whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be, and what we are going to be able to do as Democrats to make sure Massachusetts is prosperous and fair. I believe I can do that. But if I'm not the nominee, I'm going to be there on September 10th, and I know all the Democrats will be working together.
Now, if you are the – this is probably the most important question today, Martha Coakley. If you are the nominee and if you are successful on November 4th, will you continue the tradition starting by Deval Patrick and be a monthly visitor on Ask the Governor on our radio show?
Absolutely. I used to do monthly Ask the AG.
We remember you.
Yes. I missed it. Missed doing it, so I would be delighted.
And we used to dance to the music coming in. It was very boppy.
Not
music.
Me.
Yeah. Are we Martha bringing Bruce Springsteen back?
Yeah, that's right.
Let's bring Bruce back.
He's yesterday's news. Martha Coakley, what's your website, please?
MarthaCoakley.com.
Good luck. Good to see you,
Thank
Martha.
You very much.
And, of course, you know who's going to be moderating the debate on the only televised debate on Thursday
Last
night.
Last one, yep.
That's going to be...
Me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You think he's up to the task?
I think he's going to rent a tuxedo.
Maybe.
Okay. The final debate is going to be Thursday night, NECN and simulcast here at WGBH 89.7. Thank you very much for
coming in.
Good to see you.
Attorney General Coakley, thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory and our final interview with Democratic gubernatorial candidate, State Treasurer Steve Grossman. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and our engineer, Alan Mattis. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you very much for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow. See ya.